Well, last week, as Phil alluded to, we started the series in Jonah, and we will finish it next week. This series has been a blessing for me to look at, and I hope it will be for all of us today as well. I just want to give a quick recap of what we did last week. We set the tone for the book of Jonah. I presented it, as the author does, as kind of a strange book when it comes to Bible books. It kind of jumps out. It's different than the rest. It's a book of satire. It uses lots of humor and irony. We see the over-the-top nature of it. Everything's huge and big, and the good guy ends up being a bad guy, and the bad guys turn out to be good guys, and it's just all flip-flopped, and it's just a strange book. We'll continue to see that today, and I'll try to point that out along the way. We gave the backstory of Jonah himself and really focused in on the idea that this book is set apart because although it is a minor prophet, the book doesn't focus on the message that came from God to Jonah. Rather, the book focuses on the man himself, and this is different than all the other minor prophets. And the goal of that, as we will continue to see today and close off with next week, is that we identify with that. We see ourselves in Jonah's struggle. We see God's character as Jonah did, and we change because of that. And then we focus our time on the first three verses of Jonah chapter 1. We saw Jonah trying to flee God's presence. We see how the author continually points out the downward trajectory of Jonah's heart away from the presence of the Lord. And that leads him to flee. And then we focus on the heart of the issue. We said, what's actually going on here? And we saw that Jonah's disobedience was rooted in a distrust that God had his best interests in mind, that God is in fact for him. He did not trust that. He didn't believe that. He thought since he could see no good reason to go to Nineveh, there must not be a good reason to go to Nineveh. And so that heart that distrusted God disobeyed God. We'll pick up our story today in verse 4. And I want to read through this, verse 4 through the end of chapter 2. I said it would take 6 minutes to read the book. Somebody said it took them 10 this week. I said, you're just a slow reader. It's only 6 minutes, so this is going to be like 3.5 minutes right here. We'll read the passage, and then we'll get into the text. Jonah chapter 1 and verse 4 says, but the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so the ship threatened to break up. The mariners were afraid, and each cried out to his God. They hurled the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship and had lain down and was fast asleep. So the captain came and said to him, what do you mean, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God. Perhaps the God will give us a thought that we may not perish. And they said, these are the mariners, the sailors, they said one to another, come, let us cast lots that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us. So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. Then they said to him, tell us, on whose account this evil has come? What is your occupation? Where do you come from? What is your country? And what people are you? And he said to them, I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, what is this that you have done? For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. Then they said to him, what shall we do to you that the sea may quiet down for us? For the sea grew more tempestuous, and he said to them, pick me up and hurl me into the sea. Then the sea will quiet down for you, for I know it is because of me that this great tempest has come upon you. Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. Therefore, they called out to the Lord, O Lord, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not on us innocent blood, for you, O Lord, have done as it pleased you. So they picked up Jonah and hurled him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. And the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord, his God, from the belly of the fish, saying, I called out to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. For you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the floods surrounded me. All your waves and your billows passed over me. Then I said, I am driven away from your sight. Yet I shall look again to your holy temple. The waters closed in over me to take my life. The deep surrounded me. Weeds were trapped around my head at the root of the mountains. I went down to the land. whose bars closed upon me forever. Yet you brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. When my life was fading away, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to you into your holy temple. Those who pay regard to vain idols forsake the hope of steadfast love, but I, with the voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you what I have vowed I will pay. Salvation belongs to the Lord. And the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah up onto the dry land. There's a place for notes in your bulletin today, on the back, I think, if you'd like to take notes. I always encourage that. I don't typically put titles on my message whenever Mark Putty, who puts our audio online, asks, what's the title? I never have a title. But today, I have a title because I think it encompasses the main idea of this whole passage. And it's simply this: God's merciful pursuit of the disobedient heart. This is the truth that I think will guide our time this morning, how God is mercifully pursuing Jonah and saves him even in the midst of Jonah running further and further away from God. Right off the bat, when we go into chapter 4 here, I want to note what it says when it says, but the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea. And this word, Lord, I think many of us are familiar. This word, all caps, L-O-R-D, stands out, especially in this passage, against the small G-O-D, gods that are mentioned. It stands out against capital G-O-D that is mentioned. And this word is going to become important through our time this morning, and really more so next week when we see the Ninevites. But this word, Lord, all caps, is the name Yahweh. And this is the Hebrew personal name for God that they used for God. And right now, at this point in the story, Yahweh is only dealing with Jonah, and Jonah is the only one who knows the name Yahweh. He's the only one who is referring to Yahweh. He's the only one talking about him. And this is going to change. This is going to shift later on. But this is important to see that Yahweh is only dealing with Jonah now, and Jonah is the only one that knows his name. So this huge wind comes upon the sea, and there was a huge tempest on the sea. And again, I told you last week, 15 times the word huge is used in these two pages. It's just this over-the-top feel of how big we are to imagine all of this was. And then the author says that the ship threatened, verse 4, threatened to break up. And this is just a great phrase. And again, I'll just be honest, I'm going to try to point out all these things so we get the feel that this book of Jonah is just different. This word, threatens, is the word ponders. So literally we have the ship thinking about breaking up. And this is the author's intent, to give this character, like really create the ship into a character. This word is only ever used in the Bible of people. But here in this case, it's used of this ship. So we're supposed to get this idea that the ship is actually thinking about breaking up, like it has this thoughtful face on it, if you could draw like a cartoon about it. A little later on in the passage when it talks about the sea and it's raging, again, only a word that's ever used of people in the Bible, but here it's used of the sea. So this idea that you have this angry sea and you have this ship thinking about breaking up and you have this wind being hurled about by God, all these are to give it this feel of almost like a comic book, just these characters that are being brought to life, but by God. That's the key here. That's what's underlined here, that God is in control of, and he is sending these things. These things have become tools to chasten Jonah. God's punishment always comes. And we aren't really given an indication as to whether or not Jonah thought it was coming. You know, we don't know if he got on that ship just excited to be on a boat, let his hair blow in the breeze, and just smell that salt water. I just, ever since a little kid, I didn't have a chance to go on them much as a little kid, but I love boats. I always said to myself, I want a boat one day, until somebody told me that the two best days of owning a boat are the day you get a boat and the day you sell a boat, because they're nothing but trouble. But if you have a boat and you want to take me on your boat, I would love to go on your boat. I love riding boats, and I love that feel. We don't know if Jonah, he's just dreaming of that, thinking he has escaped everything. His plan has succeeded, and he is free and clear from God. We don't know. It doesn't appear that he expects God to come after him in this way, that God's chastening and punishment is coming, but it does. And there's a huge irony here because, let me just ask you, what are, physically speaking, what the passage has talked about so far, what are the three physical things that Jonah needs for his plan to work? He needs a boat, right? And that boat needs to ride on water. Rod Knutson's in the first service, and he just answers out loud. And that's what I'm looking for right here. I'm just no shame. Just answer out loud. Rides on water, and especially in the 8th century BC, what did a ship on water need to move? Sails, those aren't mentioned. It's the wind that moves that boat, right? And these are the three physical things Jonah needs for his plan to work, but what are the exact three same things that God takes control of? Takes control of the wind, he hurls it, takes control of that ship and making it think about breaking up, and he takes control of that sea and makes it rage. He takes control of the very three things that Jonah thought he had to grasp on, the things he could do to escape. God takes control. So Jonah maybe doesn't understand it fully at this point. He alludes to it later when we get to his prayer. But God is the one sending this storm to chasten Jonah. But the interesting thing is, as we read these first couple verses, 4, 5, 6, this chastening or punishment is coming for Jonah. But in these verses, who is the one who is suffering that chastening? Who is the one that is feeling the weight of that punishment? What does the passage say? Yeah, it's the sailors. It's these mariners who weren't in the story. Now all of a sudden they're here. Jonah is nowhere to be found. He's down in the ship, and as we find out in a bit, he's asleep. So these sailors, new to our story, are the ones that are feeling the punishment for Jonah's running from God. There's a couple characteristics about the sailors that are worth noting, really, to see the contrast between where they're at and where Jonah's at. The verses, you can look at them, it says, verse 5, the mariners, they were afraid, so they fear. Then each one calls out to their gods, so they're praying to their gods, they're afraid, and then they start chucking or hurling cargo into the water. All right? So those are their three actions. And in contrast, when we see Jonah, we see that he has gone down into the ship, he has laid down, and he was fast asleep. The idea that we're supposed to get here is there's this concern, and then there's this action and this scurrying about that the sailors have trying to save the ship, trying to make it right. And Jonah, on the other hand, is lethargic. He is checked out. He is unaware of what's happening. Spiritually speaking, he has gotten to a place where God is chastening him, and he doesn't even realize it. I'm going to give this illustration, and fortunately, in the first service, people agreed with me, so I didn't feel like I'm the only one, but have you ever been, this is where it most likely happens to me, I'm behind the wheel of a car, and I'm driving somewhere, probably a route that I take every day, you know, dropping one of the kids to school. My route to church isn't that long, it's just a couple hundred yards, so it's probably not that route, but some other route, and you'll get 4, 5, 6 minutes into your drive. And usually it strikes me when I cross under a stoplight and I get to the other side and I'm driving and I think, was that light green? I think it was green, and nobody honked at me. I think I was paying attention, but you're just so checked out. You're mentally just not there. Physically, you're going through these actions, but you're not mentally aware of what you're really doing, right? And you're just kind of lost in thought. I don't know what it is. Everyone's safe and you're good. I heard some giggles, so I assume you're there with me. We come to this point sometimes when we're physically doing these things, but we're checked out. And spiritually speaking, this is what's happening to Jonah. We've been using or pointing out the author's use of down, 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 down. It's used a bunch of times in this first chapter. Away from the presence of the Lord. Every action he takes is lulling him further and further away from God. And he needs to wake up. He's going to wake up physically in just a second here in verse 6, but spiritually, he's not there yet. Apparently, there's further down that he needs to go. So I want to turn our focus back to these sailors or these mariners for a moment, because that's what the author appears to do. These mariners, as we said, they're the ones that are facing the brunt of the chastening from God. So they're in a predicament that is not of their own making. It's not their fault. It's not their consequence to bear, but yet, here they are. right? And that's kind of what's going on. And this idea, I just want to kind of talk about this idea for a moment, because this idea is very biblical, and to most of us here, it's very anti-cultural. We live in oftentimes what we refer to as the Western culture, and the Western way of thinking is really no secret. It's very individualized, as opposed to much of the world, very community living, familial living. We are very individualized, especially when it comes to our choices, our morality, our sin. When it comes to those things, very individual point of view. We think that our choices, as long as they don't hurt anybody, they're okay to make. As long as everybody is consenting, it's okay to do. As long as this is just our choice and it's a private choice, it's not going to affect anyone. We have this phrase that maybe we don't use, but we hear it all the time and we understand what it is. It goes like this: what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. The idea that you can do whatever you want and no consequences will follow. They're not going to affect anybody else. It's your choice. It's up to you. And this is the way of thinking. This is the society that we live in here, especially in America. This idea that if it doesn't involve anyone, it won't affect anyone. But the Bible is not about this. The Bible has this thread that runs all through it that is exactly the opposite. And it's the truth. Just because our culture has it doesn't mean it's right or true. And the Bible's clear on this. Jonah 1 is pointing to this mindset that your choices, every moral choice you make, will eventually affect other people. It's the truth. This is rooted in the gospel. From day one with Adam and Eve, the sin of one man means death for all, yet the sacrifice of one means life for many, right? So we see it in that, even in the thread of the gospel. We could go on and point all the times in the Bible that the Bible believes that your moral choices do affect other people. And God thinks you are naive to think that the choice you make, even if it's in private, isn't going to affect other people. You can probably think back to times in your life like that. You know, you just need to ask the father who is angry. Ask his family how that affects them. Ask the spouse who's addicted to pornography how that affects that relationship. Ask the parent who has a child who is rebelling how that affects everybody around them. We could go on and on, and it's this idea that we think we have that if it's a private thought or feeling, it's just us. But that's where Jonah got messed up, because he thinks, I mean, was there even dialogue that happened between him and God verses 1-3? There's not. It doesn't appear that he doesn't say anything. He just makes this private choice to flee, and yet here men are struggling for their life because of his choice. Your sin has consequences, and those consequences affect more than just you. And Jonah is just a picture of this reality that the whole Bible speaks of. So Jonah is sleeping. He's unaware of the storm that God has sent. And the captain comes and finds him. And look at verse 6. The captain came to him and said, "What do you mean, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God." And I don't know what kind of person you are when you wake up. I'm not a very happy person. I'm a slow waker-upper. Mornings aren't good for me. My mind takes a long time to get going. I go to breakfast with Scott and Joel sometimes, and we meet at 6 o'clock, which means I have to get up in the 5 o'clock hour. And I'll show up to the breakfast place, and the two of them are all, I don't think I've ever beat you guys there. You know, they're just there, just happy to be awake, you know, and I just roll in like my mind's not even working yet. And that's I think how a lot of us are. We're not all happy when we wake up. We're slow, and you've probably also even been in a deep sleep, so deep that you kind of ask yourself, wait, where am I right now? Am I supposed to, where do I need to be right now? You're just lost, you know? And so Jonah's in this sleep below in the ship, and what are the first words he hears that call him out of this sleep? What does it say? The captain says to him, and he says, "Arise, go call." Look up to verse 2. If you were with us last week, hopefully you're tracking along. What is the command that God gave him? "Arise, go call to Nineveh." The Hebrew here is exactly the same. So, you know, Jonah, probably on his in his mind, he remembers that command of God because it's what all his actions are leading to and based upon. And so he knows he's at this call to arise and go. And now he's woken up from a sleep with the exact same words from a pagan captain. Arise, go call. And he's probably thinking to himself, is this God? Did he find me? Has he caught up with me? He's just waking out of this sleep and hearing this exact same phrase. And the irony here is Yahweh, the one he needs to call out to, who the captain is imploring him to do, call out to your God. That's the one guy, the one person, the one being Jonah does not want to call out to. It's the very reason he's fleeing from that God. Of course, the captain doesn't know this, but those are his words nonetheless. We see the sailors, the pagan sailors are all, they're calling out to their gods, and we can maybe, sometimes we feel like we can poke fun at that. Like, what does that even mean? Like, you're trying to find the God that controls this storm and trying to find the right one. But hey, at least they're trying. They are trying. Remember, the contrast is the action versus the lethargy of Jonah. And they're doing something. They're praying. They're hurling stuff over. They're working frantically, trying to save anybody. They are for the good of everyone. They're in this together, and they're working for the good of everyone. They're trying. They're literally battling Yahweh. There's this great motif that goes through this chapter of hurl. God hurls the wind, so the sailors counter back with hurling stuff over to try to save it. And then eventually Jonah gets hurled over. And so they're fighting God. They're trying. Jonah stands in contrast because the one whose trouble this is all, it's on his account, he's doing nothing. He's not concerned about anybody but himself. He's in his stubborn stupor. He's the only one, remember, Yahweh, Lord, he's the only one who knows Yahweh at this point, and yet he's the one that won't call on him. Well, the passage goes on, 7, 8, 9, 10. We've read it already. They use this method of casting lots to find out from God. It's actually a distinctly Hebrew practice of casting these lots, but they use it to find out whose trouble is, you know, the reason for all this trouble, who's the problem here. And Jonah is the, you know, however you want to say it, he's the loser or the winner. You know, he's the guy. He's the guy that they find out it's all about, and then he admits it. He says that it's him. So they bombard him with all these questions, trying to figure out, and they're asking these questions about where he's from, who he is, what does he do, who's his God, all these questions, especially in this culture. Who you were and where you were from was linked to the God you served. It was an ethnic and a deity thing. They're very linked, and so they're trying to get to the bottom of this because they perceive, even back in verse 4, that this storm is not a normal storm. There's something that has to do with a God, the gods, something that is sending this. It's bigger than just it's happening. So they bombard him with all these questions, and we can read Jonah's response, and maybe we say, well, that's pretty noble. He says, I'm a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord. But if you are insightfully reading this and not just remembering everything you know this is the biggest lie that he's told. What a hypocrite. He says he fears the Lord, but he does not. That's the very reason we're in this situation, because he does not fear the Lord. The men, on the other hand, there's this great use of the word fear through this passage. In verse 5, they're afraid, and it's the same word for fear all throughout. They have this fear, this reverence of, they feel this power is coming from somewhere, they just don't know where yet. Jonah's the one that does know where it's coming from, but hypocritically, he does not fear the Lord. When they hear that he's running from the Lord, they exceedingly fear the Lord. And then verse 16 says they exceedingly fear Yahweh. And there's this progression of their fear now has a name. And they finally realize it's Yahweh. And we'll get to that a little later. So the contrast, though, their concern for the good of all is evident because they are working hard trying to save the ship, where Jonah cares all about himself. Their fear of Yahweh, they just don't know his name, but their fear is genuine, where Jonah's is hypocritical. And even, this is a great part of the story, even when we get to the point where the sailors say, Jonah, what should we do? And he says, throw me overboard. What's their response? What's their upstanding response? What does the passage say down in verse 12, 13? It says, nevertheless, they try to save him anyway. They row even harder, trying to save the guy whose fault this is. And what we see in this passage, at every point, the actions of these not believers in Yahweh, they outshine the man of God's actions at every point. Do you see this as a problem? Do you see, does the church see this as a problem today? As you deal with people who don't know your God, who don't have a personal relationship with him, you hear this, don't you? They say, I would be a Christian if it wasn't for the Christians. And what this captain is saying to Jonah, he's rebuking him. He's saying, don't you see the situation that we're in? Why don't you care about anybody else but yourself? You claim to be a man of faith. Why aren't you using your faith to do something good with it? The commentator, Hugh Martin, says, Jonah is not bringing the resources of his faith to bear on the suffering of his fellow citizens. He is not telling them how to get a relationship with the God of the universe, nor is he relying on his own spiritual resources in God, simply loving and serving the practical needs of his neighbors. God commands all believers to do both things, but Jonah is doing neither. His private faith is of no public good. His private faith is of no public good. We're reminded of the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 5, where he says, let your light shine before men so they see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Not only are the actions of these pagan sailors better than Jonah's, but he's so caught up in himself and his private struggle that his professed faith is doing no good in this situation. What a sad, sad thing. So it was right of the captain to rebuke him, and it is right when an outside world rebukes the church. It's right and it's very real when the outside world, the unbelieving world, does that. When I was 14 or 15, I remember hearing a song, and it was on an album, so you know one song goes to the next, and one of the preludes of one of the songs was a quote, and I've never forgotten it. It stuck out to me at the time. And I remember it today. It says, the greatest single cause of atheism in the world today is Christians. Christians who acknowledge Jesus with their lips, but then they walk out the door and they completely deny him by their lifestyle. That is what an unbelieving world finds simply unbelievable. And this is Jonah. This is the man of God. All lip service, no action, no love, no care, not using his faith for the good or for the salvation of anyone else around him. So we come down in the narrative here, and the sailors, they pose this question to Jonah, now that it's clear that he is the guy that God is after. What shall we do to calm this storm? And I think there's two interesting questions as we go through verse 16 that will kind of lead us there. Have you ever thought of Jonah's response? What's his response? He says, throw me overboard. And why does Jonah insist on them throwing him overboard, right? Why doesn't he just put himself overboard? But he won't do it, will he? He insists on them throwing him overboard. And then the second question, what does Jonah think will happen once he goes overboard? And I think the answer to both of these questions, ultimately, they speak to the same thing. Why does Jonah insist on them throwing him overboard? Well, we know that God's purpose in this storm is to eventually get Jonah off the ship, right? And that's the purpose. That's the primary purpose here. There's a bigger ultimate purpose with his heart. But that's the purpose here, Jonah to go overboard. It's also clear that Jonah will not submit. He will not give in, right? And he knows this is God pursuing him. We said it before, and he says it in his prayer. It's starting to become clear that this is God pursuing him, and he gets that, and he will not give in. So this speaks to his stubbornness. He won't do it himself. And there's a great back and forth here, like I mentioned earlier, with the hurls. Eventually, he's going to be the one hurled in. God's fighting with the hurling of the wind, and then the mariners hurling the cargo, and eventually Jonah needs to go over. So this speaks to Jonah's stubbornness. And then the answer to the second question, what is Jonah trying to accomplish by getting overboard? He verbalizes it here in the passage. He says the storm will stop. But here's the interesting thing, and the great thing about narratives is you can think so much in between the lines. And the question is, okay, maybe that's one way to stop the storm, you going overboard, but just, you know, theoretically speaking, what would be another way that this storm would stop? You can answer. What is it? Or he asked for forgiveness, right? You know, I mean, that's, you know, hey, if you would ask for forgiveness, you think the storm would stop? And that's what you're alluding to. Turn, you know, let's send the ship back. Okay, let's turn the ship back. I'm asking for forgiveness. That would also do it, but Jonah won't do that, will he? No. He says, I would rather get thrown in and die. And this is interesting that Jonah won't tap out here, because it just speaks to the stubbornness of his disobedient choice. And we have found, Ashley and I, as parents, one of the greatest blessings and often one of the hardest things about parenting is that God gives you children in your life to turn a mirror back on yourself. And in one of those ways, God has used children to show us stubbornness. I mean, my dad's in this service. He remembers how stubborn I was as a child, and I see that in my children. And as they get older, I try to hide their identity. One child in particular, I'll try not to name them. They're very stubborn. If you've ever taught this child before, you're like, oh, yeah, definitely, this child is stubborn. And what gets this child in trouble usually is their attitude. And so we'll address that. We'll say, hey, listen, your attitude and you know this and that, this needs to change. And what this child knows we're getting to is, are you sorry for this? Do you see you're wrong in this? And all the time, it seems, almost always, they will not see that. So they double down, you know, and they start getting angry. And now we have an attitude problem and we have an anger issue, and they start hitting something or saying something they shouldn't say. And so now we have all these bigger issues. They're just digging a hole for themselves, all because of their stubbornness, because they will not come to the point that they say, I was wrong, I'm sorry. And I don't know about you, but I find those words some of the hardest words in the English language to say, because I'm stubborn. And this is what's happening with Jonah right here. Now, I will say, with this child in particular, we always say the pendulum swings, and they are that way, and then when they come to a point of asking for forgiveness, it's the most beautiful. It just brings me to tears every time. And Jonah's not there yet. The pendulum needs to swing there. Right now, we find he's still stubborn. He will not call out to God. Instead, he demands the mariners throw him over. So we could take this and say, well, isn't that Jonah kind of admitting guilt? He's going to be the sacrifice here, and he's going to do the right thing. I still think the right thing would have been to ask for forgiveness. And actually, this is only the first of three times in this book that Jonah asks for God to take his life. Because as we mentioned briefly, and we'll unpack next week, the problem that Jonah had in going to Nineveh is he did not want to see mercy given to people he felt didn't deserve mercy. Right? That's what chapter 4, verse 2, and we'll, again, unpack that next week. So that's his problem here. He didn't want to see that happen, and so three times he says, I'd rather die than see that happen. It'll be more explicit next week, but that's what's happening here. It's not a noble thing he is doing. He does not want to go to Nineveh still, does not want to see those people receive mercy because he believes they should justly be punished. And this is Jonah's stand that he is taking. And the thing we see here, and we'll continue to see in this book, is, you know, Jonah is standing in need of the very mercy that he is saying he is against, right? And that's what's happening. For time's sake, we'll leave it all for next week, because what's happening here too is an unpacking of the view of justice and mercy, how this works about in God's economy, and we'll cover that more next week. But the ironic twist here, again, the irony of this book is just amazing, that in demanding justice for the Ninevites by saying, I will not go because you'll show mercy if I go, and by Jonah saying, I don't want you to give mercy to those people, what's happening? God is beginning to give mercy to these people, these sailors on his ship, these pagan men, worshipers of other gods. God is turning their hearts toward himself, these sailors right in front of him. Because look at verse 14. The language now shifts. It's the first time we see it. Now pagan men are using the name of Yahweh. See how it says, "Oh Yahweh," verse 14. They called out to Yahweh. And it's all through the rest of this portion of the passage now that they are turning toward Yahweh, using his name. They've seen his power in the storm. They've understood what's happening here in the struggle between Jonah and Yahweh. And they're beginning to get a picture. And then when they see the storm stop, suddenly at the power of Yahweh, they're all in. And their fear, which I mentioned earlier, and now has a name. Because look at what verse 16 says. It says, then the men feared Yahweh with a great fear. Now it has a name. They know who their reverence and fear is for. It's this God. It's Jonah's God. It's Yahweh. And it's important to note that in verse 16, it starts with the word then. After these events, so then this happened, that then they made vows and sacrifices, and it turns to a time of worship from them. They're worshiping Yahweh, and this is important to note in that it doesn't happen while the storm is upon them. They didn't know Yahweh then. They didn't know how to call on his name, but when they see the power of how Yahweh ends the storm and put it all together, it's after that. We use the term sometimes foxhole conversions. This idea you call out to God to get you out of trouble and then you'll believe in him. That's not the progression of this passage. They see what has happened and then they believe. And this is the goal of everything in the Bible. Paul says in Philippians 2 that at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. The goal is worship. And that's what God is trying to get people toward, bring people toward. And these pagan sailors get that. And they turn toward Yahweh and receive the very mercy that Jonah was so much against. And in all this part of the story, God is the one who shines because somehow he is justly dealing with Jonah at this point by getting him overboard and getting him to a point of repentance, but yet still showing mercy now to these sailors and, as we'll see in just a moment, to Jonah. Sometimes when you're reading through something, a thought comes into your mind, and one thought came into my mind this week, just an amazing thing, I think, that speaks to the bigness and plan of God. Last week, when we said Jonah was going to Tarshish, we said, and we showed the map, how this is the furthest place that his mind could comprehend. This is the furthest place he knew where to go. It was the edge of their known world. And the reason he wanted to go there is he wanted to find a place where he could flee God's presence, in that the name of Yahweh was not known, it was not spoken. He didn't want to go there to share the name of Yahweh. He wanted to go there so he wouldn't be held accountable for those who knew the name of Yahweh and weren't receiving him. But the great thing about this story is if you just imagine, how did the name of Yahweh ever get to Tarshish? Who brought the name of Yahweh to Tarshish first? Wasn't Jonah. Probably these sailors. Right? That's their job. That's their route that they run back and forth. Joppa, Tarshish, Joppa, Tarshish. 3 years round trip. And they have learned about this Yahweh God now. And more than likely, they bring this message or this name of Yahweh to Tarshish. We don't know that, but how big and how God can work, it would not be a surprise. All this, we get lost because where's Jonah, right? Isn't this story about him? And we've forgotten about him. He's floating in the Mediterranean Sea. What's going to happen to Jonah? Well, verse 17, Yahweh, the Lord, appointed. He set this up. This, again, God takes control of this object that is not a character and makes it a character into the story. God takes control of this fish and makes this fish Jonah's salvation. This fish isn't the punishment, as we'll see from Jonah's testimony in chapter 2. This fish is what saves Jonah. This is God pursuing this disobedient, stubborn servant of his, whose heart's going down, 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 away of the Lord, still had further to go, and the furthest it could go was that moment before the fish saved Jonah. So the fish is not the punishment, it's God's mercy to Jonah. And here, in the belly of the fish, you know, once you struggle for your life for a bit, you realize there's not a lot you can do. And so Jonah finally calls on Yahweh. This is something that had been happening in his heart. This was a, a heart that led to these choices, this distrust in God, and he didn't see it. He didn't see it when life was good. He didn't see it when he thought he was getting away. But at the point when he's at his lowest, in the midst of complete failure, and this is where God brings us to so many times, now, this is where repentance will meet mercy. In chapter 2, it deserves a week on its own, but it's not going to be able to get it because we're limited for our time. And this is a beautiful poem. It's written like a psalm that Jonah writes. And I guess I just want to close. We encourage you to maybe go through it on your own this week and read it that way in the light of a psalm. But let me just close with three things from this prayer that hopefully will be an encouragement to us to look further into it. I'm going to use this structure. J.I. Packer, he was an author that wrote a classic called Knowing God. And in that book, he talks about grace. He talks about God's grace as something that people so easily think they know about. They think they have an idea of God's grace, but it's just talk, and they don't really have never really felt or experienced grace. And the reason he says that people have just this abstract idea of grace is because there are some presuppositions to grace or some ideas that we have to understand about grace and about our relationship to grace before we can receive it. And he points out some of these things, and they're exactly what Jonah lays out in his understanding of what God is doing to him in saving him from the depths of the sea and the depths of his own sin. So the first thing, in Packer's word, is moral ill desert. And that's kind of hard to understand. It just simply means deserved punishment. You deserve your punishment. And this is the first thing you need to understand before you can receive grace. And again, I think we live in a culture here in America, in our society, where we have a hard time grasping this because you hear all the time, I mean, there's books out there that say, stop blaming yourself. It's not your fault, right? They're trying to get us to believe that it's not us that's wrong here. Morality and right and wrong, it can be defined by you. So who can tell you you're wrong? So in that type of thinking, grace, it's not only not necessary, but it's almost insulting to say you need something because you're wrong. Nobody wants to say they're wrong in the first place. It's not your fault. You know, stop blaming yourself. So how can you receive grace? So this is the first thing that you need to understand, that you deserve the punishment, that it's justly coming upon you. And this is what we see in Jonah's prayer. We knew as the reader early on that it was God sending this and God pursuing Jonah with this chastening to ultimately turn his heart toward him. But here in chapter 2, we see like verse 3, he's now pointing. He says, you cast me into the deep. He understands. It was God doing it. He's justly receiving it. You cast me into the hearts of the sea. It was all your waves, all your billows passed over me. Then I realized, I said, I'm driven away from your sight. So he understands here that it was a just punishment that was coming for him because he deserved it. He acknowledges this punishment is just. Secondly, the word that Packer uses is spiritual impotence, and this is just simply saying that you can't fix yourself. You can't save yourself. I like to think in my life that I want to fix things. I want to make things right. I want to make things better. How can I do this? And maybe you're the same. We live in a world where even in our lifetimes, we have seen technology advance to the point where, man, what can't be done with technology, right? That's what people think. Or medicine advanced to a point that what can't it make right? And this, it's no surprise that this same thinking bleeds over into religion. What can I do to get right with God? Well, of course I can do something. I can do good things enough that God can't say no to me. He can't say no. He's got to receive me or got to think things are right. And this is kind of how the thinking goes. If I'm able to give enough effort, God will have to receive me. But Jonah realizes that he can't save himself here. He look at the language of verse 5. He says, your waters closed in over me to take my life. The deep surround me. Weeds are trapped around my head. He says, I'm closed in these bars forever. And it's interesting to note that this prayer of Jonah comes from a time when he's in the fish and he has no hope or promise of escaping that fish. So sometimes we know this story and so we think, well, you know, we know he gets out, but Think of the hopelessness that Jonah has in a physical way, knowing that this might be the end of me, but yet his heart is turning toward God in this way. And he's realizing that not only does he deserve this punishment, but he can do nothing to save himself. But then he says, verse 6, it shifts. He says, "Yet you brought up my life from the pit, O Lord." And if we ever read that verse in connection with Jonah, again, we would think this was after he got spit out from the fish, but it's not. He realizes that this mercy has already been shown. All right. And then the third thing, in our understanding of receiving God's grace, we must know how costly it was. And this is something Jonah couldn't fully understand or know, especially at this time in history. But it's interesting how every time Jonah refers or looks up to God, he's never looking to God in the heavens. He always refers to it as in your temple, your holy temple. And this meant something for a Hebrew. I don't know what it means to us, probably not what it meant to a Hebrew, but Jonah never saw the fulfillment of what the temple represented, how it pointed to Christ and Christ's sacrifice one day, but Jonah did know the temple, and he knew the mercy seat. He knew that the mercy seat was where God promised to speak to his people, and in that temple, over that mercy seat, on the Day of Atonement, the priest would sprinkle blood to atone for the sins of the people. Tim Keller, the author, says this: "What a picture. The temple was the residence of the holy God. His perfect moral righteousness, represented by the Ten Commandments, which were under the atonement cover, which no human being has ever or can ever keep. How shall we approach God? Won't the law of God condemn us? Yes, it would, except for the blood of the atoning sacrifice on the mercy seat, shielding us from its condemnation. It's only when the death of another secures our forgiveness that we can speak with God." So Jonah doesn't know it here, but what he's referring to is he's referring to a time when the death of another would secure the very forgiveness that he is going to receive in this moment. It's an amazing thing. He acknowledges that he doesn't deserve the punishment, he can't fix himself, and not fully understanding it, this forgiveness is coming at a cost that would come one day. And this is the truth that allows Jonah to be forgiven hundreds of years before the cross. It's the truth that allows us to be forgiven hundreds of years after the cross. Again, physically speaking, Jonah may not have understood or believed even that this fish was going to be his salvation, because he didn't know it was going to spit him out, no knowledge of what God would do. But in a spiritual way, he understands that this was God's salvation to him and his stubborn heart. And we're going to leave Jonah right here, right before we get to verse 10 of chapter 2. We're going to leave him in the belly of the fish, and then we'll find out what happens next week when he comes back to dry land. But we glory in this, that there's a merciful God that pursues not only disobedient, but stubbornly disobedient sinners. Let's pray. God, we thank you for the time we could have in your word today. And we know that your Holy Spirit is the one who applies truth to our life. And we just want to come humbly and continue to be humble this week and having your Holy Spirit speak to us where we need it in the stubbornness of our sin. And we just thank you for the mercy that you offer, even though our hearts think we can do it our way and we have that fundamental distrust in you so many times. We thank you for this, and this is in your Son's name we pray. Amen.